Hi, this is Ritu Banerjee. I'm the Senior Director for the Canada Centre for Community Engagement and Prevention of Violence.
Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name's Craig Forces. Stephanie and I are together again in the observation room of the University of Ottawa's courtroom.
And I now like to think of it as the summer Intrepid podcast.
Intrepid Studios.
Yes.
And Stephanie, today we have yet another pod site and a guest.
Right. We're going to be speaking with Ritu Banerjee, who's the Senior Director of the Canadian Centre for Community Engagement and the Prevention of Violence, a.k.a. the Canada Centre, or the CCCEPV, which also sounds a bit like a communist volleyball team.
Right. And this is all tied to the ongoing conversations about terrorism and how to respond to the terrorist threat in 2018 in Canada.
Is there a problem? I hadn't noticed.
Okay, and so on to our interview.
So, Ritu, lots to get into today because I'm not sure how many people are actually familiar with the Canada Centre. So why don't you speak a little bit about it and how it came to be?
Sounds good. So when new government came into existence in 2015, it was part of our minister's mandate letter to create a center. And that's pretty much one of the key impetus for developing the Canada Center, which is in the Department of Public Safety. So we're within the department. We're not a separate agency. And we have a mandate, and we were fortunate enough to get funding in the 2016 budget. So we have a mandate to do policy development, provide programming support, and do research. But a key underlying theme to that, which is evident from our title, is engaging Canadians and broadly speaking, all communities and various stakeholders. And we need to do that in order to have the best possible policies and programmings deep down that can address issues around radicalization of violence. So our mandate is really focused on countering radicalization of violence, and that for us means really it's the focus on the path to violent behavior. It's not so much being a radical. Being a radical is legal in Canada. We have freedom of expression.
Right, you're allowed to hold terrible opinions.
Yeah, you are. So long as you don't cross a particular threshold into violent behavior. And that's really what concerns us. And the other part is, in terms of terrorism, we're looking at all kinds of threats. We're not fixated on one type of threat. That may be the most prevalent one, but we're certainly conscious that there are other issues at play. Obviously, we have to prioritize our business because we have limited resources. We have to stay focused, but we are concerned on the range of terrorism threats that are affecting Canada both domestically and could be coming at us from an international perspective. If you look at our history, we have been inculcated with different kinds of threats for many, many years. And so we recognize that fact. In terms of the team, it's a pretty small team. We're 13 people.
And
I can explain a little bit of that because part of the role is to do policy work at the national level. But the policy work we do is actually going to be affected and delivered at a local level because whatever we do has to be relevant at the local, to address local realities. And that includes programming, which could be intervention programming that could be led by law enforcement or local community organizations, but that will ultimately be in municipal or provincial jurisdiction. They can't be managed by the federal government. So that's why we're very conscious that a large part of our work is built off relationships, collaborative relationships with provincial and municipal stakeholders, levels of government included, as well as community organizations. So that's kind of in a nutshell how we're set up. In terms of the funding angle, which I know will be of interest to many people, it is a gradual ramp up of funds. So when we're at full strength in year four.
And you're in year two?
We're in year three.
Oh, okay.
We're entering year three.
Okay.
It'll be $10 million ongoing. And what that means is $3 million for the center to operate and function, and $7 million in grants and contribution funding. So that money can go out the door to different organizations to do various kinds of things, and it also includes research support to address issues around radicalization and violence. So I can talk more about that later, but just to kind of give the overview of what our function is.
Right, and this didn't come out of nowhere, like the because there had been research to kind of study these things previous.
Absolutely. So in the department, we had dedicated funds under the Kanishka funding umbrella, and that was focused, though, primarily on research. It was $2 million a year for 5 years. And that was a part of the response to the Air India disaster. So that laid a groundwork on what was happening in Canada. But like many things, especially in the area of national security, historically, we haven't had that infrastructure like many of our allies have had with think tanks dating back many, many years. So it was an effort to create that community through TSAS, or the Terrorism Security and Society Network.
Which we're both members.
You're both members. There are many, many good folks.
They retweet us. Thank you.
Who are part of that collaborative effort. But those things take time. So that's what Kanishka did. It created that infrastructure. It also created some very good research. And in the department, within the purview of the National Cybersecurity Branch, we were doing some policy work. But what was required was important to have some focus and leadership and to coordinate efforts with other government departments. This has traditionally been seen as a security problem, and it is, but a lot of the solutions require working with social actors and social or healthcare professionals. There are many ways to address issues of radicalization of violence. Some of those involve a public health approach. So you need to have people who are specialists in psychology or psychiatry, youth, as well as law enforcement. So you need to kind of bring them all together. And for that, you need to bring in other departments and agencies, such as immigration from a settlement perspective and integration perspective, heritage from a how do you avoid polarizing communities perspective, racism, hate crime, employment skills development, also from a working, like how do you get employment, youth skills development, different other approaches. Those are still early stages of development, but we needed to bring that, to move the file forward, you had to create that focus within the government. So that was really, it was a gradual approach, but that's kind of the impetus to get us there.
So Ritu, just to be clear here, it's not that you're knocking on doors of homes of families and saying, here, I'm from the federal government, from the Canada Centre, and I'm here to help de-radicalize or prevent radicalization of your child. You're not playing any sort of operational role.
No, our job is not to deal with individual cases. And I think that's the conscious decision and a mandate decision, because as a department, we're not an operational department in that case. The individual cases are managed by the security and intelligence services as appropriate and as is relevant to their mandates. Individual cases are also managed through multi-agency hubs, which we may fund at the federal level, but we don't operate. So, for example, Calgary, which has had some issues with terrorists and individuals being radicalized. Oh, and I do want to get back to the issue of nomenclature in a minute, because you mentioned de-radicalization.
Right.
What we would do is they have a multi-agency hub, some call it a situational table, that is led by the Calgary Police Service. And they're trying to provide specialized support to individuals who are at risk of radicalizing. They may be in the criminal space, but most likely they're a little bit outside.
So by criminal space, they haven't crossed a criminal line yet.
They're on the police radar, and it's usually police officers who'll know or see what's going on. But they'll do their own risk assessment and determine if other tools can be provided to this person. Sometimes they're young people, to give them other off-ramps. And so that's the conversation that will happen through this table. And an interesting and an important part is the privacy aspect, because there are different privacy laws across Canada. And to manage that, what normally happens, it's led by law enforcement. They'll have a case file. They will bring the other relevant municipal actors. So it could be youth workers, health, education, social services, depending on each community, how it gets set up. They say that they kind of explain the case in an anonymized fashion, Then there's a determination made amongst those actors who should be the lead. Those who are the leads get together separately and get the case file.
So it could be public health. It could be other
education.
Education.
Okay. Yeah, and then they take it, they run with it,
right.
And off they go.
Right.
So that's, and then it's no longer, police don't have any more role.
And so Calgary's an example of that. Where else have we seen these sorts of more localized hubs?
So the localized hubs that are led by law enforcement, Toronto. Toronto Focus has already had tables in place for other kinds of criminality. So we're really trying to leverage an existing resource and infrastructure that's been proven to work. And the multi-agency hubs, just as an aside, they've been around for many, many years. Prince Albert in Saskatchewan started it off based on what was happening in the UK. So it's been tried. So Toronto has the Focus tables. And there, what they're trying to do is add expertise around radicalization of violence to those tables. And they work with the City of Toronto, the United Way, as well as Toronto Police. So mm-hmm. It's a partnership with community and the city. Ottawa Merit, so Ottawa Police Service, has the Merit table. And then British Columbia has they're going to be setting up a process for the entire province.
Right.
So that's early in the works. So those are the main ones.
And Montreal is a completely different kettle of fish.
There are several centers that are not led by law enforcement. So we have in Edmonton the Organization for the Prevention of Violence, which is NGO-led. It's got academics, community members, youth workers. They're doing a bit of a threat assessment for the province of Alberta, and the goal is then to develop more tailored intervention long term. In Montreal, which has a completely different approach, they've got two centers. One is the Montreal Center for the Prevention of Radicalization of Violence, and the other is Sherpa, and I won't be able to give you the acronym. It is fairly long, but Sherpa is what you can find them by. They are led by, well, they're a combination of researchers and psychiatrists, and they take a public health approach to dealing with not just issues of radicalization of violence, but a range of public health issues. And they've been around in Montreal for many years. They operate out of Park Extension, historically dealing with immigrant communities on a range of social economic issues, but now are turning their approach to dealing with radicalization of violence.
My understanding is the Quebec in Montreal, they're at more arm's length from the authorities, from the police.
So the Montreal Center is definitely arm's length. It is an NGO. They are funded by the province and the city, but they consider themselves an NGO and are trying to establish a very clear demarcation with law enforcement. Their rationale is that is the way they'll be able to earn the trust of the communities. And they provide sociological, psychological support, social supports, and they do a lot of training and research. Sherpa is funded by health in Quebec. So it has a link to government. But because they're medical professionals, many of them, they're going to have, again, very strict rules around confidentiality.
Mm. So this is just an opportunity because you've mentioned the public health model a couple times. Maybe it's worth just explaining what that is for everyone.
Well, I think people think, especially in the context of returnees, because I know that's on top of mind for many people. People perceive they've done something wrong, they come back, they need to be put in jail. And I don't disagree that there is definitely a criminal justice approach to dealing with individuals who have, or where there's evidence and where you can convict people, that the criminal justice system has to play a role.
We spend a lot of time talking about the intelligence and evidence issues.
Exactly.
They're at stake, right?
Yeah. At stake.
It's the theme of our podcast.
and complicate things incredibly for this particular issue. I think what we're trying to do is provide different options, because the path to radicalization, I mean, there are many different viewpoints in terms of how quickly it happens, how it happens, but part of it has to do with what you're seeing, thinking, and feeling about yourself vis-a-vis the rest of society. So looking at it from a psychosocial perspective is one way to see how you can get somebody off that path and provide those appropriate supports. To do that, you need to make sure that other kinds of healthcare professionals, social workers, you know, other professionals, non-security folks, are comfortable with the issue. Because the minute you say terrorism, unless you know you're national security geeks, people don't get excited.
I wouldn't know any national security geeks. Certainly not in this room.
People don't get excited. They get scared.
Right.
And they get reticent to get involved, and they want to just shy away from it. So part of this whole process is, and that's part of what Sherpa is also doing, is they're training social workers across Canada so they can develop a network, so they understand what is meant by terrorism or what is meant by radicalization of violence, and what are the appropriate professional tools they can use to counter and help people get off this difficult path. Our job is to look at everything before the boom. We want to avoid people to get to the boom, to
the
action.
That's the center's focus.
That's the center's focus.
Right.
Law enforcement has its role to look and investigate, as does CSIS, as do provincial police forces. They have their role, and they're doing their role, but they can't also be social workers. And sometimes they get put in a very awkward position. So our job is to find the other tools within society, leverage those tools, provide the training through, you know, other interlocutors, provide the support for the training so that they're also equipped when it's appropriate. Some of the challenges we see is we're setting up an infrastructure, different models across Canada, and we support that. We are tying researchers to these models so we can measure and see whether or not it's effective. So Ryerson University, for example, is teaming up with the RCMP, Toronto, and Calgary Redirect to do the measurement and evaluation from the get-go. So it's part of the program design. They can course correct, and we can see if it's actually producing results.
So best practices, and then presumably you can share that across the country, and you serve that facilitative role.
Absolutely. Right. Not only best practices, but then we can translate that. If there's another community that wants to set up a hub, ideally we can transplant.
So we're not starting from the beginning.
Exactly. Right. Because up until now, even though Kanishka did provide a lot of basic sort of groundwork, there wasn't a lot of Canadian applicable data. So we had hubs, but we didn't know if the hubs worked in this context. We had no way of measuring it. We don't know what success means. We haven't defined it. We need to define success. And that's a lot of the work that Ryerson is doing. Similarly, Simon Fraser has been teamed up with BC to do the similar kind of evaluation. And then they're trying to do it right from the beginning. So you don't wait 5 years and then find out nothing's been working.
Right.
So that's part of the approach. And the non-governmental approach is also interesting to see, is that an effective model? Does that build more trust within communities? So we're working with the Montreal Centre on the research side to see, does it work? But from a Canadian perspective, unlike a lot of our allies, we don't have a monolithic approach. We're trying to be as diverse as possible to reflect the diversity in the population.
Right, and our system of federalism too.
Absolutely, no one owns this problem. It's a shared responsibility. It's I think our job though to provide the leadership because of the pan-Canadian scope of this issue and provide as much support as possible. But we have to work closely with our provincial and municipal counterparts.
Right.
So I just wanted you to break down CVE just a little bit more, because there was, you know.
And by CVE, you mean?
Countering Violent Extremism. Look at me, I'm already speaking the jargon. But I think that, we've heard a lot of allegations of, oh, we're reading poetry to terrorists and things like this, which was unfair and probably inaccurate.
Yeah.
I know this, but so can you talk about like the difference between preventing and reacting or responding?
Absolutely.
So you wanted to come back to the vocabulary.
Yeah, the vocabulary.
So the one thing I did want to talk about, and this brings to the vocabulary, the notion of de-radicalizing.
Versus disengagement.
Yes.
Right.
And I think so. Okay, we'll start with the preventing versus responding. And I think the job of the center is very much in the early prevention spectrum. So some of that involves education. For example, digital literacy is a buzzword that's up very prevalent these days, especially if you look at the notion of terrorism in the online sphere. Not just terrorism, but violent extremist propaganda. So how do you make people more aware of what it is they're looking at and reading? And it has applications in other areas too, of foreign interference and espionage. You know, right. Like, what is it that you're looking at?
We're trying to rebuild civics, basically.
Yeah, and unfortunately we are. But just be more critical thinking, so you don't get sucked in or manipulated by what is being seen. And some people are more vulnerable to that. But that's kind of at a very basic level. So making sure people are much more aware and critical thinkers. And then in the more middle ground, providing this infrastructure or the different off-ramps that are being supported either by law enforcement or it could be community organizations to support those individuals who may be at risk. Some are earlier on in the risk spectrum, some are in that middle gray zone, and those are the ones that need more attention. Then you cross over into people who are actually engaging in criminal activity.
Right.
That is not the job of the center. That is the job of the law enforcement community and the intelligence community to sort that out. They will respond as they normally do, as is appropriate. They enter a criminal investigation. If there's enough information and evidence to charge somebody, they will work with the Crown to do so. And the intelligence service also has its thresholds on when it can, you know, intervene and monitor somebody. So that's really where the demarcation is. Now, we work, obviously, with our intelligence and RCMP colleagues, because we need to understand the threat from a very general perspective, because you don't want to be putting resources where it's not necessary. You also need to know how the threat is developing and changing, especially in the online sphere where it goes very, very quickly. So that's how we stay involved. And we also need to make sure that if we are working on these multi-agency hubs that are law enforcement led, they make good sense from an operational perspective. So that's how our relationship is, but we don't deal with, as we talked about before, individual cases.
So there's another stage though. So you've crossed the line into the criminal space now, and so the lead agency at that point is going to be the RCMP. CSIS has presumably also got a parallel investigation underway. There's two possible outcomes there. There's the prospect of a successful conviction, in which now you've incarcerated someone for a term of years who will be released. Mm-hmm. And I understand the average age of release for those who have been incarcerated in Canada, thank you, Michael Nesbitt, who pulled the statistics, is around 40. So a relatively young person who will be coming out of prison, presumably no happier about the society they live in. And so there's an issue of, I guess, what we would call rather than de-radicalization. We can't change what people believe, but perhaps we can encourage them to disengage from violence.
Yes.
So there's a question of disengagement in the prison setting. So that's one issue. The second issue is the circumstance where you believe but cannot prove that they've crossed the criminal line. And so either your prosecution is unsuccessful or you're facing the sort of dilemmas that we've alluded to in relation to returnees. That is, that whatever they did is in a foreign war zone, and therefore it's very difficult to bring a prosecution, and yet they could pose a danger. And so are you left in those circumstances to simply watch?
Well, here's the complexity. So, yes, disengagement versus DRAD, and I think you've covered the basic reason why. As a state, it's very difficult to change somebody's belief system, to measure that, and that's not necessarily our role, but we can provide support systems to help people disengage. Some of those support systems could involve hubs. It could involve the hubs that are led by non-governmental organizations like the Montreal Center. So they could, we haven't gotten there because we don't have that many cases of people coming out.
Of prison.
Yeah. And they could involve individuals coming back. So the returnee issue. The biggest challenge in some of those cases, it's a little bit murky on the prison side because it depends if they're on parole or if they're just released.
Or in a peace bond.
On a peace bond, is the issue of consent.
Right.
So if you're not able to put any kind of structure around it through the criminal justice system, if all you can do is watch, then the only way you can compel somebody to enter or to take any kind of assistance is voluntarily. So the issue of
peace bonds don't work.
No, I'm not talking about the peace bond case. I'm talking about an individual, let's say they're coming back.
Okay, a returnee.
Let's say we're talking about a returnee.
Okay.
So somebody returns, and what I'm saying is your criminal justice levers are limited. So you can't prosecute them, and you don't have enough information to
Get a peace bond.
Get a peace bond. Yeah. Right. So then.
So this is our worst case scenario, basically. Assuming this person really, we have intelligence that suggests that the person was bad actor in Syria. The intelligence comes from SIGINT or from a foreign service. We can't use it in court.
That's one scenario. Or you don't have
any information at all. So you don't know what they did. Which is probably more likely. Yeah. It's probably more likely you don't have any.
You may not have a lot of information.
Yeah.
Or the information you have is muddled.
Yeah.
Right? It could go many different ways. Right. And I think the worst case is you have a parent with a child. And that gets even more complicated because then how do you manage that relationship? And it's possible that the parent may continue to radicalize, or it's possible that the parent is very mentally, you know, they have
damaged
suffered
from
damage.
Yeah.
They've suffered trauma, both the child and the parent or parents. It's a complicated situation because you may not have anything, any levers, any legal levers to compel somebody to do something. So in that case, it's all about consent. So how do you convince that individual that it is in your best interest to get some sort of support from the state? And then what I mean by support, it could be psychological support, like the kind that Sherpa could offer. It could be the kind of support that Montreal Center has as well. There are different ways in which we can facilitate that, but that is a live question, and it's a complicated question because of the issue of consent. Then if you are looking at individuals who are where you have levers, so if you have somebody released and they're on parole, that's a lever.
Or even incarcerated, literally.
Yeah, incarcerated. Yes. Although I think the complexity is there. Like some of our allies have many numbers and they're trying different things.
Right.
Segregating
so
people.
Segregating, putting them in the general population. And so the dilemma there is you segregate them and you've got a hot house for terrorists. You put them in the general population, you've got radicalizing agents in your general population. So what's the perfect solution? And I think no one's found the Goldilocks point here.
No, they haven't. And I think the challenge in Canada is the numbers are still relatively small within the prison population, and they're not all in one.
Yeah, so we're talking about 25.
Yeah, so that makes it harder to also develop a very standardized programming set. But I guess in those cases, and if you go back to the issue of peace bonds, and there are a number of complexities around that, that's an open question. And I think for us moving forward as a center is to look at, are there programming that we develop in the community that could be of assistance in the context of a peace bond? And I think it's worth exploring that. But I think we have a bit of a ways to go to figure out what that programming would look like, also sensitizing courts and crowns to the validity of this programming. And that's why the research is so important, and setting up these centers and infrastructure across Canada really does become important.
Right, and I imagine coerced or compelled participation in a program is a very different space than if someone comes to you to one of the institutions that you're funding voluntarily.
Or because their family convinced them to.
Right. Yeah,
yeah. So,
and that's where the importance of family or the network, and I think Paul Gill talked about that and continues to talk about that.
Gill being an amazing counterterrorism researcher with the University College London.
That's correct.
Yeah.
About the relationship of the bystanders and especially the immediate, and it could be a parent, it could be a sibling or a very close friend who usually knows something is up.
Right. So this was his finding that in 50% of cases,
someone knows.
Someone leaks,
yeah.
Right? Or there's leakage to that person.
And the American data is consistent.
Yeah. So if we can basically get those people to encourage that person to go seek help or channel them to a program or, you know, as the old expression has it, if you see something, say something,
right.
Then...
And that might be easier to do if in doing so you don't run the risk of the person being swallowed up into some intelligence/law enforcement exercise. And so I think that must be part of the motivation for the Montreal Center and its approach.
Absolutely. And I mean, they're pretty open about that. And but I think the challenge still remains is how do you build a certain level of trust in society amongst communities so that people can feel, even though they don't have, they may not want to go to law enforcement. I can appreciate that. They don't want their child necessarily to be in prison, but they know something needs to happen. So that's the other part, is creating those safe avenues where people can go somewhere. And oftentimes people talk about a hotline. I'm not sure hotline necessarily is the answer. Because
we already have hotlines.
Well, there are many
police hotlines, right?
There are. There are police hotlines, but a lot of this has to be localized for the individual communities. And so it's finding that sweet spot that's going to be really important moving forward.
Just circling back to the issue of peace bonds, as you know, in the Aaron Driver case, at least in the initial bail conditions prior to the actual imposition of the peace bond, there was the question as to whether counseling would be part of the terms. And the court this is the lower court in Manitoba, the lowest court you can have, a provincial court in Manitoba, concluded in a very peculiar decision that amounts to about a paragraph or two on this, that would violate Section 7 of the Charter. I haven't met anyone who's persuaded by that argumentation, not least because you would have thought it would have to be addressed under Section 2 of the Charter, which is the freedom of conscience and expression provision. But one of the concerns at that time was there wasn't any programming, right? And so to say that you have to undergo counseling, what does that mean? In the absence of any programming, there is the risk that it will be counterproductive. And we know that from cognitive bias, that one of the things that can reaffirm and entrench and deepen a person's perspective is to challenge them and confront them. And people, you see this on Twitter, right? There's nothing worse in terms of persuading someone on Twitter.
People only ever agree with me on Twitter.
Right. But that sort of in-your-face confrontation. Yeah. So if you don't know what you're doing, then the risk is you'll actually cause more of an entrenchment of these
views.
And so it seems that if you're going to pursue this seriously, you really do need the sort of thing you've been describing, Ritu, which is something that's carefully thought through, that's fact-based, that's ground truth, where there's been reflection, does it work? And, of course, this is such a novel area, right, this whole issue of disengagement, of preventing radicalization to violence, that the social science is lagging behind the facts on the ground, at least it seems to be from my perspective, although I imagine it's made enormous steps in this area. So, it's a very fertile area.
It is, but we shouldn't ignore the fact that a lot of these disengagement tools have been used in other forms of criminality.
Gang violence, right.
Radicalization is a little bit different because the motivation angle and the ideological angle is different than in gangs. But that doesn't mean we have to throw everything
out. Different incentives,
But I think there's a lot we can learn from that. And that's what I think everyone's trying to do. But the point is, these programs, while they're getting set up, they're not going to happen overnight. And we're trying to manage it so that we're starting with the bigger centers because they already have the infrastructure. But we're very cognizant in smaller areas. How do we get tailored expertise to people? So that's something we're going to be looking at longer term, is how do we develop those networks for the professionals, but also for the community, so they have a resource.
Right. Well, and of course, in the wake of 9/11, all of a sudden, everyone was a terrorism expert. And so, in the wake of preoccupations with counterviolent extremism, the concern is that becomes the flavor of du jour.
Yeah.
And so there's an issue also about the credibility of the programming and the credibility of the experts. Let me ask you a question. So these issues of the soft approach versus the hard approach, not an idea I like. I like the idea of a toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a toolbox. You've got different tools. You can reach for tools depending on conditions that drive that decision. This is one tool. It's not the only tool, nor does this tool prevent
other things from being relevant
if they meet the criteria, right?
And we always say we're complementing. Right. We're not mutually exclusive from what law enforcement or what social policy to do.
Right. And a lot of people don't seem to understand that. They see it as a
black and white.
Coddling.
It's a dichotomy, right? It's either the soft or the hard, and the two don't meet and they're opposed. And so that's a very difficult political space, it seems to me, to operate in. So, of course, the concern that I imagine a lot of people would have is, so you do have a programming system of some sort, whether it's in the space of disengagement or in an effort to stave off a move to radicalization of violence. Person goes through the program, and yet something goes boom, right? And so no system, of course, will ever be perfect.
No.
And so if the program runs and is perceived in a high-profile circumstance to fail, what sort of space then does that leave for the future of these sorts of programs?
That is a very good question.
We haven't got there yet, right?
No, and let's hope we don't. But, I mean, it is, and I'm just wondering if anything like that has happened in the UK, because they've had a more established with their channel program for a while. So I'm wondering if they've had any incidents or issues with individuals who've gone through channel and haven't necessarily met. And I don't recall any. I think that's why for us, the biggest issue I mean, and we are relatively new, is building the trust and resilience with communities.
Right.
Because we need to make sure we're credible with what's going on in Canadian society. That's why we've been trying to focus more on the, in the early prevention space, the higher risk part. So the people who are at risk of radicalizing. So that's why the multi-agency hubs are first and foremost our big priority. So we have some infrastructure. But longer term, in terms of developing our national strategy, we have started to consult people. It's been incremental. It's been working with provincial and municipal counterparts to develop those networks. But we're going very quietly and slowly because this is not about big bang boom slashy program. This is really building that trust at a very deep level. And with government, especially the federal government, that takes a long time, especially... you know, outside of Ottawa, it will take a long time. So we have to be very patient and methodical in what we do and use those vehicles to build that trust. And hopefully that provides us with that resilience if there is something.
So manage expectations in terms of what this program can accomplish and what it can't accomplish.
Absolutely.
And just getting back to your idea of a toolkit, though, it's like how, I guess the other question would be like how versatile are the tools? Because a lot of people think these centers are just set up for only Al-Qaeda and Islamic State inspired extremism.
No.
And right. And so it's like, so there's been a lot of talk, particularly in the wake of the Toronto attack, about like other forms of violent extremism. So can you talk a little bit about how, I mean, I guess you can't go into too much detail, but like how other forms of violent extremism fit into this as well?
Well, I mean, we've observed, I mean, there have been public incidents with the far left, Antifa, also the far right, in terms of violent or behavior that is really crossing the line. And I think the challenge, and I think the director of CSIS has talked a little bit about that, is, you know, when does something become a national security threat? You know, when does a group actually have the motives and the means to instill that kind of violence within society? And that's tricky. And many groups are very good at staying right under the surface and being able to express themselves, but again, hitting that very fine line that doesn't cross into necessarily hate speech or doesn't become a hate incident. But our area, in terms of our own preoccupation at the center, we're conscious of issues around hate and polarization. While a lot of the programming and that space is the lead of our colleagues in Canadian Heritage, our concern is if the areas around polarization are not addressed, and a lot of that is spewed on by radicalized behavior that leads to violence, society is going to become even more polarized. And that's not healthy. And that's not healthy for anyone, especially in a society like Canada that is so diverse and multicultural. If we're not able to address those behaviors leading to hate-related incidents and crime more effectively, that's going to cause some serious problems. But it's a much more challenging dilemma for us.
To back up just a second, is there any international equivalents to you that you're aware of, or is this like a unique Canada thing?
Well, they don't necessarily call it that. I mean, the Home Office has an entire prevent.
The British Home Office, yeah.
Sorry, the UK Home Office, so one of our allies, they have the prevent section. So they would be an equivalent, but they operate very differently because they are a unitary form of government. It's a lot more centralized.
Right, so it's like, it would be like the equivalent of the federal to our municipal.
Yes,
and,
right.
And a lot more intrusive legislative standards that other actors in civil society are expected to meet.
Yes, and I think, but I would say that in Europe generally, the acceptance of the state to intervene is much higher. And if you look at a country like Denmark, different legal thresholds around what constitutes crime prevention, which allows them to share information much early on amongst law enforcement on issues related to radicalization of violence. So I'd say, because we did look at this when we were trying to set up the center, that most countries do have within their ministries of interior equivalent or public safety equivalents an area that deals with radicalization to violence and countering it specifically.
Right. I guess one thing I always like to ask people who, particularly in this space, and frankly, it's, you know, I think it's also important because, you know, you're a great woman operating the national security space, and I have a lot of female students who sometimes feel that, you know, they're not unsure if they can work in this area. So I always just think it's nice, like, just to describe, like, what is it that you do on a daily basis? Do you have, like, a actual, like, daily routine?
How did you get to where you are?
Okay, the easier question is the latter question.
Right, okay.
okay, but on the first question, on the routine, I don't have a daily routine. Oftentimes, my day is dictated by whatever the pressures are, whether they're...
Headlines?
It could be headlines. It could be whatever senior leadership, you know, are interested in addressing. But, I mean, from a very mundane aspect, I like to get in early and go through my emails to get myself in the right headspace. And I think a key thing is having a really good team and being able to amass people who can complement your skills so you can trust them to get a lot of work done,
you know,
collectively. And then that's really the important part. I'd say I kind of stumbled into national security. I mean, but my background's in law and South Asia studies. Very different things. And I worked at the Solicitor General of Canada. It's many years ago. And then stumbled into the National Security Policy Director at the time as an analyst, working on the 2001 Parliamentary Review of the Anti-Terrorism Act.
Oh.
So this was in 2004, but it was that version of the Anti-Terrorism Act.
The so-called five-year review, which was closer to seven. But
yeah. Well, it started then,
right.
But then it kept going because there was a government change. So that was kind of how I got my feet wet. And it's been working at public safety, Privy Council Office, and the MAC at public safety in this area. But I want to see more women in this area. Yeah, I think it's fun. It's challenging. I mean, the issues are incredibly complex, you know. And, okay, we might be the geeks, but still, I think they're quite exciting. They're topical. They are in the news, which makes it challenging, but that's also what makes it kind of exciting because you can see what changes you can bring to this. I mean, it's real.
It's dynamic.
It's very dynamic. And a lot of interesting people.
Great.
Thanks very much, Ritu, for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
Becoming an alum of Intrepid Podcast.
Indeed.
And we've given you your pen.
Yes, that's right.
The much coveted Intrepid Podcast pen. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, everyone.